Hello, everyone. Welcome to Two Sides of the Same Coin, our podcast. This is Thurl.
This is Roy.
We're excited to have you join us today. We have a very, very interesting guest, somebody we've been looking forward to talk to for quite a while. We have a special relationship with him right now. We'll get into that later into the show. But joining us also are some of our fellow special lady friends who are part of the show. We have, who do we have here, Roy?
Well, we have over to my left, Luana, and then a little bit to my right is Sway.
These are very important ladies in our lives as working with us on the show. We're all coming to you to talk about this special guest. His name is Jake Brown. We'll be getting into an interview with him on this podcast, talking about a plethora of things with this show. We're excited to bring you aboard. Should we welcome Jake Brown, everyone?
Let's all welcome Jake Brown. Jake Brown, Jake in the Brown. House. Two sides of the same coin.
Welcome,
Jake.
Congratulations on launching your show.
Yeah, it's been a long time coming. We were supposed to do this a couple of months ago, but it's been a process, buddy. But yeah, we're glad to have you aboard.
Yeah, we're excited.
Well, thank you.
Let's jump into it.
So how was your trip to Washington, Roy?
Oh, yeah.
I just went to Washington, right?
Okay,
right.
He's the interviewer. Oh, yeah, it was awesome, man. It was great, you know, for a great cause, you know, working with an organization called Dream Corps. And we're pushing, trying to help get across legislative initiatives pertaining to reform, criminal justice reform.
Speak a little bit about the particular legislation you're working on, Roy, with the Dream Corps that we're working on.
Yeah, we're working on the Equal Act. And so that's where we've got a problem when it comes to incarceration pertaining to cocaine versus crack, powder cocaine versus crack. And so there's a disparity in terms of the sentencing based on those two, the way they make that particular drug. So again, I'm not familiar with cocaine or crack, never used them, but at the same time, there are a lot of people who've been unjustly incarcerated due to this disparity in terms of how they're sentencing based on these two, these products. So we're trying to push forward to get that changed. We've got some good people on the right as well as on the left supporting us. And so we engage them in meetings. And so we're looking forward to them helping get this legislation across the line as far as being passed, because there are a number of people in prison for years that they should not be still in prison because of this disparity. So I was excited about that, and I look forward to going back and continue to talk about it.
You know, I ask about it because I've written books. I mean, obviously we're working on y'all's book in this spirit, but I've worked with other, in some cases, artists, in other cases, who had careers that had to go on hold because of some kind of a silly sentencing thing. But for those that don't have the advantage of a support system, as you guys experience firsthand having one, but still, you know, it's almost, and I'm sure your conversations with these congresspeople help flesh this out. I have found it's almost harder when somebody's trying to get out and get back into society because they have to pay for their freedom, and they have so many restrictions against them that the normal person wouldn't have working against them just trying to get a leg up. It's amazing to me the amount of expectation that is set, but yet how much weight is put on at the same time to try to lower the expectation that they'll succeed. It blows my mind.
Right. Well, one of the other things, speaking of that, you know, it's good you touched on that, Jake, because another thing that we're working on is, you know, the First Step Act was legislation that was passed almost 5 years ago in 2018. And what that dealt with or deals with is people trying to come back into society. Reentry is what it's called. And so we're excited about that. That has been very successful. We've had a 12% recidivism rate, which is very low for people returning back to prison. The general population coming out of prison is at around 40%. And so this program has been very effective at reducing people coming back into prison based on how it's set up. So, there's still a ways to go to get it to where we want it to be. But at the same time, it's a great program. So you're right as far as what we're trying to do legislatively is help people not go back.
And I want to jump in here a little bit on that subject too, Jake. as you know, obviously what we've been through and what we've come home to. But there's a lot of politics behind that right now. And that's something that we're looking into and dealing with, too. It ebbs and flows. There's a time when it's politically correct to talk about criminal justice reform. And then just on a drop of a dime or just on a certain movement, it becomes something that politicians and the like run away from. That's something we're experiencing in this election cycle right now.
Right.
It's almost like a dirty word on some point. But yeah. The Equal Act that Roy's been working with and advocating for through Dream Corps is something I support also. We know a lot of men when we went through, we met a lot of guys who we heard their stories and we were just, you know, blown away by the years and years and years of unjust drug sentences that are out there. But the political winds have changed right now. We're moving in a direction where they're trying to argue for more incarceration, while at the same time, more people than ever are coming home due to the First Step Act that was passed. There are even some politicians running for it that want to rescind it, if you can believe that. So we'll get into that in a different conversation in depth, but I appreciate you for bringing it up for us and sharing that with us. We want to also jump into some other things. We've got a couple of young ladies here that's got some really interesting questions for you. You are a biographer, a well-known, well-rounded biographer. You started in this industry really writing about a lot of music artists. We are particularly interested in the first artist that you wrote a biography about, a guy named Suge Knight. I think everybody's heard about him. We're all L.A. cats, Roy and I. And the stories that you've written about some of these artists are dear to us. But let's jump into a couple of questions right off the rip. Luana has a question for you. She's been biting at the chump to ask you this question. So go, Al. Go ahead and give him your question.
Hi. How you doing? It's such a pleasure to meet you and finally get to put a face to this name. Roy and Thrill, they speak so highly of you. And, of course, I had to go Google you and read up on you a little bit. So I'm curious to know, when you wrote Tupac Shakur biography, which is one of my favorite rappers. I mean, he's my favorite, hands down. Did you do his biography through the words of his mother, or was it actually? Did you actually interview him?
Well, he had passed away by then. No, so in fact, it's kind of interesting. Last Friday, I spent about an hour and a half on the phone with Jeff Perlman, who is more popularly known for writing the show that became the Lakers series on HBO.
Okay. Yeah, great series.
He's presently writing a like a definitive Tupac memoir.
Okay.
The book that I wrote with his mother was called Tupac in the Studio. And it was authorized by the estate, one of only three books, I'm proud to point out, that was authorized by the estate. And in fact, Afeni was so protective of her son's legacy and how it was going to be curated and presented, that there was a 275,000 book destruction order from a court from one of these unauthorized thrown together books back then. So, I really had a lot of respect for her because I went about putting this book together before I brought it to her, which is how I always work. I go out and I interview all of the principals I want to get done. And then I bring it typically, not always, but that's how I've done it, because you have a better chance of getting to a yes if they can see you've already done your homework and you already have gotten people to speak to you, which is 95% of the lifeblood and bread and butter of being a memoir writer or biographer. And I don't do unauthorized, other than the very first few books that Thurl mentioned. I started out, even the Suge Knight book, which is still the only Suge Knight book that is about him, and has kind of, I think, stood the test of time a little bit, because there's no anonymous sources. Everything's on the record. Everybody that I quoted is on the record. And that was very important to the Tupac Project, because there had been so much just BS written about him. And I grew up on him. I grew up on, like, I'm 47 now, but I was in high school, high school and college when all that happened. And so I wrote with a bit of authority as a fan, but I also talked to Big Psych from Thug Life very extensively. I have the only interview with Johnny J that he ever did about about their collaborative, long form studio collaboration, spending days in the studio recording all of those masters that became the Machiavelli masters, and then Suge Knight and Buffini had the court battle and the judge split ownership, and then that became the basis for all those posthumous albums. So we chronicle the creation of that entire catalog. In fact, then in more recent years, in the last 2 or 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, I've been slowly but surely assembling interviews with the rest of most of those producers. Wow. There's going to be a reissue 20 years later coming next year from Blackstone. With Tupac in the studio, updated through to the present. And I did a lot of interviewing with Moprim Shakur, with his brother. I have pretty much the entire Thug Life crowd in there. Anyway, it was, yes. Yeah, so writing with the estate was very, it was incredible. I mean, it was 20 years ago almost, and it's still a career highlight moment for me.
Wow.
Can I ask you, when you was interviewing the late Afeni Shakur, was she giving you... giving it to you in a raw, like in the words of her son, did you feel like she was like just giving it to you how her son will speak to you if he were to be alive at that moment?
She didn't really have any direct commentary to contribute to the book because we were talking about his studio process, but she reviewed every single word of the book and went over and edited it with me. And she was very much a voice in the background. Nice. And Amber Books, who won the NAACP Image Award for publishing, really? And was the publisher, Tony Rose. Yeah. Tony Rose gave me my start, way back in 2001, with that Suge Knight book. But, it had a lot of supervisory, let's just say, guidance. Okay. I also helped them finish the Rick James book, and that involved working with the Rick James estate and interviewing his housekeeper and kind of documenting those last few years that they didn't have. So I was lucky early on because I wrote a book with Anna Nancy Wilson for Heart. But that Tupac book's important because it started my In the Studio series, which has been in now publication for 17 years, and I own the trademark on it, and it's been put out in 8 countries around the world and counting. Wow. Anyway, that book is still very near and dear to my heart.
Yes, nice. It is.
Well, I got to ask you about the Suge Knight book. Obviously, it was unauthorized, and, you know, Suge Knight, and this was early 2000, so I believe, or was he out at that time? Did he was he out of home? Prison? Because he's in prison now, but he was out around that time, wasn't he?
Yeah, not yet. No, and it wasn't unauthorized.
Oh, he was still in prison. Okay.
We went to Death Row.
No, he worked with them. Yeah.
I went through Death Row Records for that, and I who was an independent at that time, and you could actually call them. I had gotten a literary agent out of complete accident on a bet as I was writing press releases for a couple record labels. And she said she had a book project she needed done with this very bad band from the 80s that I would not work with. But I said, look, I can bring you a project, and if you can sell it, and this happened to be on Shook, I wanted to write a book in real time with his release. So we had tacit okay from Death Row to do it. And basically the deal I made, you know, with the parties that I won't mention now, but that I talked to at the time, had to do with Suge wasn't going to give any interviews because at that time he was going to be doing American Dream, American Nightmare, which ironically was represented by my present agent, Frank Wyman, and written with Neil Strauss, who did the Motley Crue, the Dirt book, but because of legal issues never came out. So our book beat all of them it's the first book out and still the only one you found on store shelves. And the reason for that was we wrote it in real time with this release from prison. And I painted a very fair and even-handed portrait of Suge Knight, which is that Death Row Chronicles that I narrated for BET, I made this case very, I think, fairly, because he talked right after I did in his interviews from LA County Jail. And the argument that I made is that Suge Knight took the same exact tactics that white record executives from Mob, bookmakers, from the organized crime element, and that ripped off African American artists for decades across multiple genres. And he flipped it and he applied the same measures, kicked the door open, created the first truly owned by the artist, by the label masters. Ruthless was joint venture. People don't talk about that very often, but it led to so many other entrepreneurs, like Sean Combs getting his Bad Boy deal, like Jay-Z getting Rockefeller, like Master P getting the distribution, like Cash Money, and on and on. Without him, you would not have had Tupac bailed out. You wouldn't have had Dre released from his contract, no matter how it got done. We wouldn't have the Chronic. We wouldn't have many the amazing Chronic. Moments.
So you think a lot of artists model like Master P, who became, you know, record label executives, do you think they sort of modeled what they a little bit after Suge Knight? He kind of set the stage.
Not the violence.
He didn't go turn anybody upside down. Give me your master.
Nobody hung anyone upside. Yeah, they all modeled.
No, but I mean,
Suge.
In terms of the ownership, you know, model, the as far as how you were going to own it.
In the music industry, where artists like them, upcoming, could own their masters, own their not obviously the distribution part of it, because we know there's a larger arena of executives that deal with distribution, because that's the whole part about getting a record deal. We had
that was Interscope.
So yeah. So we understand that. Roy and I was fortunate enough for a minute to have our own small label, MN Finest Records, that was distributed by Universal Music. So we understand how that process works and how those deals typically go down. But that all kind of started in the fact that we were in our position, in the small position that we were in for the time that we were. That all came, you're saying, from the Suge Knight type relationship that he built with Interscope.
Well, in part, yeah, because what the Interscope did was take a chance on him and on Dr. Dre, because they wanted to be in business with Dr. Dre. And whether people want to give him the tactics he used to get Eazy-E to release him and DOC from those contracts, they were slave contracts. They were draconian, man. DOC was signed for a watch and $500. It's a joke. So all of the vehicles through which they eventually got those, you know, because it wasn't just those releases. There was a racketeering case that had to be settled out of court and mediated. And the judge in the court said it was clear that those contracts were really null and void. But because Jimmy Iovine took Suge under his wing, and also then, you know, for that period of time where they were under Interscope's watchful eye is where they really flourished. It's when they moved into Can-Am and had full autonomy of their own complex and could beat the crap out of a engineer who rewound the tape too far and just let that gangster culture run too wild. And it was way too much. I've interviewed the majority of those engineers. The only place that stuff was not allowed per Suge's order was the studio. So if you came in and you were like they had a famous rule. If you walked in with your homies or someone brought you in and you were a rapper and you wanted to be on Death Row, Suge would have you rap right there. And if you didn't impress them, you'd get beat down for interrupting their stuff.
Wow.
Yeah. So that gang culture was pervasive throughout. Right. The only thing that's interesting is that Bloods and Crips both hung out together there. So there was a unity element. Also importantly to Roy's question, Death Row was the first label ever to put gang signs and gang colors on the music videos. And they were really, NWA was responsible for really bringing the whole gang culture into the suburbs. But Death Row took it to that next, they took it from an R-rated to kind of an X-rated level in terms of being completely transparent about it. And then the other thing that happened is that, you know, in real time with everything they were rapping about, they were also artists were being arrested for first degree murder, like Snoop or Tupac's first two lines of California Love out on bail, fresh out of jail. They glamorized and sensationalized in a way that had never been done before and made almost a cool factor having a kind of a criminal record whilst at the same time a criminal credibility, street credibility, while at the same time really making the argument that you could get out of that world through music. So it was really like kind of a juxtaposition at the same time that it worked together and eventually worked against them, because everyone says, oh, well, you know, with Tupac and them kicking that dude, Orlando Anderson, beating him down. Well, if he had survived the shooting, but he would have been violated back to prison because he was out on bail and Suge would have been violated.
People don't know that. Right.
That would have been the end of it anyway. They had an amazing run and then it was just over. You know, it was sad.
Because it was over for a lot of us. That a run that was amazing. All of us being big fans of Tupac.
Well, actually, I think that's what put Suge back in prison was him being caught on videotape.
Yep.
Yeah, kicking that guy. So he got nine years. Violated for that. Yeah.
Oh wow.
When he came out, and you guys made the connection to put the biography, his autobiography out.
Well, it was not. that was with the okay of Death Row that I write it, but it was not authorized. And Suge did not get the interview.
Oh, it was not that part of it. Okay.
Suge okayed it eventually, and I got kind of through different people I was familiar with or had a, you know, relationships with a little bit there. It got his blessing, but it was never, he didn't authorize any books ever. Mm-hmm. And I think that was also importantly because of his whole street credo, of not really ratting or not, you know, that right, sort of right. thing, mm-hmm. because a lot of the things that I had to bring up in the book. Now, a lot of the points that I made in the book, when he did his 2018 Death Row Chronicles interviews from LA County, where his wife and attorney later served time for because they were not supposed to facilitate those.
Really?
They were done in an attorney client room on a third party phone. In those interviews, he confirms much of what I, at least in my book, said, because he never held Vanilla Ice off a balcony. He leaned him over the balcony. It's a distinction without a difference. But admits doing it in the Death Row Chronicles, but he denied it for years before. At that point, he knew he was going away for life, or the equivalent of it, and he had nothing to lose. And so it was really, if you really want to hear about Suge Knight, those Death Row Chronicles, it's an amazing. Yeah,
let's talk a little bit about that.
I gotta ask one question. Writing an unauthorized biography, did you ever worry about him showing up at your door?
No, I took the gamble that would be part of the appeal, honestly, and it worked, luckily. It became a Vibe top 20 hot street something. They had a list back then, and it got reviewed very well in Ebony. It got all of the right people like that were going to give it a good go lined up behind it. And then thankfully it just kind of, I think it within, I mean, they used it as the source material for the Death Row Chronicles. That was 15 years after its release. 16. So I'm just saying that I tried to make that the model in a lot of ways for the kind of memoirs I write, because I think it's cowardice to write about somebody else and quote someone else without sourcing who they are so that everybody can see. It's one of the great banes of social media is there's so many cowards that will talk about people but not identify themselves. That's changed somewhat on Twitter. And Twitter, today it's less allowed than it used to be. But
yeah. You did an unauthorized on Lil Wayne. What was that like?
Yeah, that was a money book, man. I owed that publisher, that same wonderful publisher that had given me for Amber. They bought 2001. They bought Suge Knight, and then I wrote a book on R. Kelly in which I indicted him as a sex offender in the introduction. Right. Yeah. I the only condition on which I would write it is that I was able to make the true argument, and you can read it right in the intro from 2003, that he was a sex offender, that he was a sexual predator, and that he preyed on young girls. Mm-hmm. And it was I got a lot of heat from them and from Doubleday, and I had to write a new, when Doubleday acquired it, I had to write like a new foreword that by then it was 2005 and his trials were happening, and I had to like explain how he had been keeping himself.
You're talking about R. Kelly. Okay.
Yeah. So that one came and went, but then I did Biggie, 50 Cent, Tupac, Jay-Z, Red Hot Chili Peppers, Kanye West before he went El Bolo Loco, and a number of other entertainers, Amy Winehouse.
That was a different one.
I love
Lady Gaga. Yeah. All for Tony. So for over that 10 years, there's about 20 books in that catalog that just one after the other, sometimes two and three a year. Yeah. And it was the last era of mass market paperback. So that was also a really unique era in publishing because it was different. Well, you were in many more copies out there than would have been now.
Right.
So let me ask you this. When you do unauthorized biographies, what is your source material? Because obviously you're not speaking to the artist themselves. Yeah. How do you?
It's been like almost 15 years since I've written one of those. I did them in an era where unauthorized memoirs, authorized biographies. I always had interviews in there from like engineers or band members or people. And then when I started doing in the studio books, those are exclusive. Even if they were not blessed by the band directly, I talked to all the producers, all their engineers. I cleared it through management. But the unauthorized biographies that I did were always sourced. So in other words, every single word you read in there was on the record. You could go and see from the court documents and something like Suge, or you could see everything that was there. And then I think all these books made their way to these artists. I know for a fact every one of them was seen, held, read in some cases, and none of them did I get back? Hey, they're, you know, every one of them, when they got in the hands of the artist, less Biggie and Tupac, because they were not with us, bless their hearts and rest in peace. But there was roundly pretty positive feedback. In fact, I turned down being in a lot of those R. Kelly documentary things over the years because I just didn't want anything. The only book I won't, I just didn't want anything to do with that one. Yeah, but the rest of them, I think, hold up pretty good.
Yeah. You mentioned me in a conversation.
The rest of them hold up.
You felt a little different about that particular book. I think that was with R. Kelly. Was that in 2004 or 3 or 4 when you wrote that? What was the title?
It came out in Your Body's Calling Me, The Life and Times of Robert R. Kelly. Came up with by the publisher. Yeah, I got my little advance and wrote it, and they took it.
I remember you telling me about that
thing with it. But
hey, Jake, we have an aspiring writer here, and she works with us, and she's a special person in our world here. Her name is Sway. She's sitting on the couch there. She's got a couple of questions.
Oh, well, hello, Mr. Brown.
Absolutely.
So I do have a couple of questions.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm happy to be here with these two because in the works for a while.
Right.
Okay, I would say I did watch a couple of your interviews with other podcasters, and I do remember you saying how there was some of the people you were working with and you wasn't very fond of them. So how do you put your personal or your emotions away when you're working with those individuals?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think to clarify what I had said, I was asked a question about meeting somebody that you were a fan of musically. And then when you started collaborating with them, you discovered that everyone's human and that behind the songs and the onstage persona, I was disappointed. I have had a lot more experiences where I was very happy, thankfully. Joe Satriani, I wrote a memoir with Strange Beautiful Music. These two could not have been nicer. Anna Nancy Wilson from Heart, Lemmy from Motorhead. The Shakur State was very, very respectful and nice with me. I think that the answer to that question depends upon the circumstances. It's not often for me that it's the direct party. It's a lot of times the people that surround them. So, for instance, I've been writing with, so like Teddy Riley and I have been writing his book for almost a decade. It's just now been sold. We're not announcing anything about it yet because I could get in trouble for that. But it's finally sold. In the 8.5 years we worked together, there were five managers that came and went. There was attorneys that came and went. I wrote a book with Big Smoze, a country rapper that had the show on A&E. In the time that I worked with him, he fired his manager, he fired his booking agent, he fired another booking agent, he fired another promoter. So sometimes the pressure that's on these ladies and gentlemen, and if you see it writing over 2 or 3 years or 5 years or however long it takes to do a book, you do really get a bird's eye view. So to answer your question, often it's not so much the artist because you can't really judge them because they're under a set of pressures that's almost unique to any other. And Roy and Thurl can speak to this because they went very far with their artists in terms of pushing them. There's a team, and that team is there, and everyone on that team is there because the artist wants them there. That doesn't mean that everybody on a team around that principal is going to get along if they were in any other scenario. They might not sit next to each other, for lunch or even be in the same kind of restaurant or et cetera. Right. So, but it breeds into you an understanding of being a team player and understanding that even though you're writing with one person, there's a lot of people reading what you're writing. And there's a lot of people that are going to have influences over what winds up a lot of times in a final memoir. If it's a band thing, that's different because you're going to have 5 points of view anyway. And that's the best way because then you've got 5 different aspects of the same story being told and they all have different memories of it, but they can verify in certain details. It's trickier when you have a management team that has a kind of image that they want that isn't going to always comport with what the facts actually are, and you have to find a nuanced way to present that. And I'm not necessarily naming any specific books because I wouldn't anyway, but I've actually walked away from more projects because of my, I'll do like some sample interviews and then I'll kind of meet the team maybe. And it's not even always that I'm the one saying yes or no. They might get the sense that I'm not willing to bend this to some kind of a that, because there's also really strict libel laws And if you're a biographer and your name is on the cover with an artist, I'm not a ghostwriter other than working, you know, with like our hosts. If my name's on the book, I'm as legally responsible for the content in that book as the person, the principal that told it to me. So if it turned out that they exaggerated something or put someone else in a light that then they didn't, they read it and say, that never happened, I don't remember that, I can get sued. So there's a huge amount of stress that accompanies dependent upon the team getting it to the finish line, because you have to give everybody the same respect and ear and hear their version of a story, and then go back to the artist sometimes and they say that never happened, but then maybe they were drunk or maybe they were on stage or maybe they were whatever it was and the other person was at, you know. So it's not for the faint of heart, is to answer your question part one. Part two is I think that the other point that I was making in that interview was that there was one particular artist that I wrote with for another, it was almost a decade, and he had Parkinson's disease. It was Freddie Powers. And Merle Haggard was a big player in that book, and Willie Nelson and Big and Rich and Tanya Tucker and all of these country artists. And it's through them that I actually started this National Songwriter Series, which has become a, for me anyway, in this, in country music, a very, very, it's a one of it, the only book of its series of its kind that does all the songwriter profiles. But that was a real interesting book because you got to see loyalty on a different level. And loyalty is something that can really be measured in the number of years, not only that somebody knows somebody, but also the points in the peak and valleys of an artist's career where their friends are there for them, where the money runs out and there's somebody that's going to step in and finance a tour or finance a record or do a favor and produce a song or give a publishing interest into something that they don't have to because they know the party needs the money. In Freddie's case, you know, his bus would break down and Willie Nelson would write a check to fix it, or John Rich would write a check, or they would send him a bunch of gas cards in the mail, or the Music Mafia would rally and do a fundraiser and, you know, all sorts of things.
Interesting.
Yeah, so that was an example that was really inspiring to kind of see all the people that rallied around this guy in favor, paying back the favors he'd done, getting them a start in the business or getting them their first cut on a record or getting them a gig on a tour that wound up leading them to land in the band permanently or whatever have you. But it goes all over the map. The main thing is to make sure that if you're going to write with somebody that you might not otherwise write with, but you know it's going to benefit their career, and you might just be the right writer, you just have to really be chameleon-like, I think, in your tolerance. So if you might otherwise be driven crazy by something, just go in there and prepare to deal with it and get to know it and understand it, because it might be a big part of their personality, and it might pull a layer back that they might not otherwise tell or show you, but through getting to know that difficult part of them, you're going to get – I interviewed for Kenny Aronoff, rock drummer's book, John Mellencamp, who I grew up listening to intimately and musically. And I talking to him and hearing him talk about how he was with the band now and how things would have been different if he'd handled himself differently and if they had, and when him and Kenny parted, it was an interesting moment because it's a famous breakup. So to hear them both with the benefit of 20 years be able to talk a little differently than they might have 20 years ago was, you know, and it's the same. I'm working with Corrupt on his book right now from the dog park, and that's an ongoing project. And, you know, we talked to Doc, we're talking to RBX, we're talking to Dad, we already talked to Daz, but there's a lot of people in that camp. I can write a book with all of the principles of Death Row because I'm very familiar. I'm as familiar with the story as I would argue historian wise, a lot of people, but I'm also going to get all the perspectives. I'm not going to get one person's perspective that's blend. Corrupt's telling a story that's transparent and will give you examples of quote unquote difficult personalities that when you see what they went through, a lot of in hip hop too, you got a lot of people that come from a street kind of mentality because that's the mentality that also exists in the record business. The respect aspect is huge. The perception of disrespect is huge. It can last for a really long time. And if you're trying to get an interview with somebody that feels like, you know, they had a falling out over something like that, it's my job. And I've had to do it a few times where I got to convince them that the book's going to come out anyway. And without their story being in it, they're being robbed of their chance to give their point of view on it, even if it's going to disagree with. So well, it yeah, there's all kinds of well, aspects.
To what about Foxy Brown? She dated Corrupt, so
we're gonna cross that bridge when we. That's something corrupt. Obviously, he's the boss, so he'll tell me if he wants to feature.
All right. Do you have another question, Sway?
I do. Like, with all you just explained to, knowing that you have like a job that needs to be done. So how do you push through the days when you just like don't feel like it, knowing that you have so much you have to do?
Well, I worked for an Thurl, what's our threshold for vulgarity on the show here?
Have at it.
Have at it.
I give advice. In 2020, we did a 50th book campaign, right? That was based off the failure of a book's release right up there behind me, the 600 page songwriter or country music producer book. And so we were left with just, what the hell are we going to do? And the publicist orchestrated this whole wonderful, brilliant, I never thought would happen kind of thing that led me to do a lot more of this kind of Zoom based podcasting and talking about with other authors or aspiring writers. And one thing that I'm to answer your question that came up over and over and over again is that if you're gonna commit to a career of being a writer, it is a tough. Now, it's no tougher than being a construction worker or an insurance salesman or a contractor or any small business. But it's a small business. And if you're not entrepreneurial about it, if you're just creative, you need to have somebody in your corner who is doing the entrepreneurial work, whether that's your wife or your husband, depending on the dynamic, or whether that's an agent, which is the road I most recommend. You always need to have somebody in your corner. And the reason for that is because you're going to encounter things that are going to frustrate you, that are even going to be out of your hands, that you need somebody to help handle. Because if you handle it directly, it's going to come between you and the person you're writing with. Whereas if it's a money-related matter, which often it is, that's got to be sort of sussed out by the people who can actually talk about that stuff. On the other hand, there's also the fact that when you're a biographer, you literally inhabit the people that you write with. It's a very – it's almost like a ventriloquist meets like kind of like a vertigo acid trip sometimes, because what you're doing, and that doesn't mean anybody should try acid if they want to get the sense of this, but you have so much of that person's personality in your mind. And then you also have all of the other people that are principal to that particular book, and they're all talking and you can hear them. And once you know their voices, you actually hear them telling you like the stories that you took from them, and then you're creating narrative around it. Or if it's what's called first person and it's in their voice, like for instance, the book that we're working on with Roy and Thurl, we made a decision creatively early on that to try to tell this from Roy Thurl, Roy Thurl, Roy Thurl back and forth. I think this is what we're still doing would be insane, because it was too hard to follow. They were telling the same story with different points of view, but that was the same. So we decided that what's called a third, it's basically a singular voice, but it's the two of them as co-authors. And because they're twins, they have a simpatico, I suppose you'd say, that like we did it with Heart this way, that really can work.
But you're having
to live with these people in your head, and it can really make you feel like you're going crazy sometimes. But you have to find the therapy is getting it on paper, and then they read it, and then the number one thing that you'll either get back to let you know you did well or you did badly, or that you're somewhere in the middle, is this sounds like something that I would never say, even though they exactly told you what you wrote down, or they told you something where there was a lot more beneath the, it was really cool or whatever the surface answer. And it's your job to try to flesh out how they felt or what. And if you're, for instance, working with like Teddy Riley, like I have for nearly a decade, I know him so well. And I have also, as his rabbi, i.e. biographer, been told everything. So I sign really strict non-disclosures. So when I write with somebody, I'm getting probably 50% of what they tell me doesn't go in the book.
Teddy, you know, obviously,
there's a balance.
80s and what's that?
I was just saying there's a balance. Oh, sorry, the feed cut off. There's a balance between the two that you find the middle of, and that's the voice that winds up on the page.
Right, and you mentioned Teddy, and we've talked about this a couple of times. You said it's been a long process. Obviously, everybody knows him from New Jack Swing type of a sound that was.
He's the father.
The
father of
New Jack. The king of New Jack Swing. Yeah.
King of New Jack Swing.
I wanna.
Yeah, he took it all the way to the 80s, to the Michael Jackson Dangerous album. That's been a 10-year process, and you're still dealing with the process.
We're done now.
Oh, you're done now? Well, what was why was it 10 years?
Yeah, why was it 10 years? And what's that like when you're dealing with artists?
Well, I want to be careful with, you know what I can't stand is when someone's asked something and they're like, oh, I can't talk about that. Like it's some big, you know, right. I can't say anything. So I'll try to say what I can because we just sold the book. So there are certain things that I legally am contracted to not talk about with it. But I want to preface that by saying that it's no secret we've been working on the project. It didn't take 10 years because – it didn't take 10 years. First of all, it was 2023? So it was 2014 that we started writing. So coming up on that. But – we met through another book project called God, I've written so many. I'm sorry. It's called Hip Hop Hits. And I interviewed a whole bunch of – it became Doctors of Rhythm, which it's much more known as an audiobook and has done much better as. And I have all the producers in there. I do my narrative and I plug in their original. It's really cool. Scarface is in there and all kinds of cool people. But for Joe's chapter. But anyway, we met through his chapter interview for that. And – I implored him to write a book with me because I had been a fan of his as a small child. I'm a multi-instrumentalist by ear since I was a young kid. Music is my first, as a songwriter, producer is my first thing anyway that I've always done that led to the rest of this. But
isn't
I grew up on New Jack.
Because of that.
Yeah, and I live in Nashville. I grew up playing all of Teddy's songs, whether they were on drums or keyboards or I love them. They're huge, you know, from Kool Moe Dee and Bobby Brown, obviously.
Wow, wow, wow. How you like me now?
Yeah. Bobby Brown. So New Jack City. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Remember New Jack City?
Oh, yeah.
Movie.
Of course.
Loved it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
About five times or more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right? So
I don't think you know nothing about
Teddy,
that, Sway.
I don't.
I don't know nothing about that.
Yeah. So it took as long as it took, not because we were struggling with anything, but because Teddy is very, very busy. He tours the world.
He went
to Japan to do K-pop for a while, if you remember, launched that whole
I remember you telling me he was over in Dubai for a while and you were trying to deal with that part of it.
He was in Dubai. He was in Africa. He lived for 3 years. So he has a global following.
He lived in Africa for 3 years?
For 3 years.
He lived in Africa for 3 years? Wow.
Literally.
Wow.
He has a house there. So it took that long because just of his natural career movements. And we weren't in a rush. We wanted to just do it right. Mm-hmm. And also, Roy, to answer your question, sometimes when you finish a book doesn't so much depend on when you're like the end. But he has had these eras. So as an example, in 2019, he got his Hollywood Walk of Fame star. We wouldn't have wanted to put the book out before that was in. And we didn't know that was coming. So then in 2020, Versus happened. And Babyface and Teddy's Versus was indisputably the biggest one of the entirety of that thing. It was on CNN and People and Variety and Hollywood Reporter, and they had the big breakdown, and then they had to do it the next night. They each saw their Instagrams go to over a million overnight from like, you know, respectable 200,000 levels. They were on the show there that was on the Comedy Central that they've been – so much media came of it that became the ending of the book. We concluded the first. So had we not had the – sometimes when you're writing with an artist, you're dealing with the real-time motion of their career and things are going to be, you know, a little quiet, then they're going to get big. Right. In Teddy's case, the reverberations of New Jack Swing also meant that a lot of the legacy stuff was only started happening in the last few years. And we wanted to capture all that in the book. So we knew that was coming and we just wanted to wait to get the whole story.
Do you think he – when you look at it historically in hip-hop as a whole, do you think he's – more valued in hip hop or in music than Dr. Dre is, as far as
I don't know that came
right after, you know, Dr. Dre sound, you know, the West Coast sound came a little bit right after New Jack City, New Jack Swing.
They came at the same time, actually. His chronologically, if you look at
NWA, right,
correct, right.
But NWA,
and then you know, Death Row came, and then it was seemed like a whole new era then. You didn't really hear as much about New Jack Swing as
more the East Coast
sound. The East Coast sound as well.
Until Diddy came along with his music, with his sound.
Think of this, too. At the same time that Dre was inventing what would become G-Funk and whatever the earlier NWA sound was, Teddy was in the St. Nicholas Projects producing Go See the Doctor and The Show by Dougie Fresh in 1986. Uh-oh. 87, he was doing this at the same time. Yeah, so there was a parallel. And then bear in mind, after New Jack Swing kind of had its day, what did Teddy do next? No Diggity. That's a whole new sound that came out
with Dr. Dre
featuring as a verse,
right?
Rapping on there. So that shows the mutual respect that those guys had for each other as innovators.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But music is defined by the era. I mean, you had what was the one that started taking over? A Dark Child that took over
for a little bit
and had a little run. There's just been so many different eras of music. With how things have evolved. And what I like about you as an author and in your music studio books, you've been able to travel along with this whole ride. I mean, you've worked with so many different artists from different eras and genres, country music. I remember you talking about how you started in the hip hop industry in your first series of books, and you were dying to get out of it because you had spent so many years writing about hip hop artists. You were like, God, what I'd give to do a country album or something like that. And then you ended up working with a band that, believe it or not, Ru and I'm sure LaWanna knows a little bit about, Heart, which was the two female groups. A lot of people know that. What was that like when you talked about working with them? Because they never did books with anybody, and you were able to snag them to do a biography.
One of only three.
One of only three, correct.
Yeah. It was life. It was career-changing. Absolutely career-changing, life-changing. Because the Tupac Shakur book opened that door with the authorized, you know, working with the estate. But then to actually have a living band to write with, and I got everybody. Yep. The 70s version of Heart, the 80s version of Heart, the 90s version of Heart. Sue Ennis, who co-wrote all the songs with him from the 70s. So we, and then what I did with that book, interestingly, is I took a big gamble and interviewed everybody first. And then I had gotten to know a guy named Howard Leese, who's just a genius guitar player that was the guitar player from the 80s, 70s and 80s, actually. He gave me Ann Wilson's email, the singer, and I just pitched her cold. She forwarded that to her manager under some, I'm sure, not the happiest in the world with the, how I went about it. But I was young, and it was also a gamble. And they actually said, let's do it, rather than scold me and tell me we're going to sue you or, you know, some alternative answer. And yeah, they were just really cool. You know, they were really, really, really. Nancy Wilson is a little bit more chatty about both eras, whereas I think Anne, without any big secret, prefers the 70s as a glory area to the 80s, because the 80s.
I'm trying to, between Nancy and Anne, which one's the blonde? Is that Nancy?
That's Ann, the guitar player. She sings too, but Ann is from Mary Singer. Yeah,
she's the blonde. Okay, there's one more. There, you know, it's a brunette, and then there's a blonde. So,
the brunette is Ann. Is that correct?
Yeah. No, they're.
The brunette. That's Ann, right?
Can you define them both by their hair color?
Yeah,
I know we always kind of knew them as.
I'm just curious which one was.
Yeah, they have what's called sibling tonality too, which means they sing as sisters in a very unique way to probably to your brothers when you two were producing gospel records.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I got to ask you about this. We live in Minnesota, obviously, Minneapolis. You spent some time.
Oh, Prince.
Yes. Talk to us a little bit about what that was like being in the studio at Paisley Park and I loved Prince.
I was not in the studio at Paisley Park.
Tell us about
what I did do. Yeah, I was able to get Susan Rogers and a bunch of these books have been done now since he passed. But fortunately, we got all the engineers from the principal 77 to 94 glory era, I suppose you'd say, of hits. And we just talked about the making of them and the hours that they literally sometimes 24-hour sessions they spent slaving away with him. And he'd have three studios running at once. He'd play 35 instruments so he could go in and lay down drums in one room and then go do bass in another and guitars in another and vocals on this. And he had insomnia. He almost never slept. So he'd go home and sleep for 2 hours, come back and work for 10. It was just an attempt to try to just capture. I grew up probably Van Halen, Jane's Addiction, Motley Crue, and Prince, like my four main influences without counting hip hop. And Prince wise, I know his cat. I mean, I had all those the 1,000 unreleased songs the estate's been putting out now, I collected as a kid. I would pay a fortune to order them from Moonraker in Europe or at the store called Vintage Vinyl in St. Louis where I grew up, where they had them. But yeah, we just capturing the mood of him working and what he was like. And, you know, he was a very, very grumpy interview giver. So he did not allow journalists to record him. They had to write down what he said, which is never going to be completely accurate. So using the engineers to kind of help recreate those descriptions where he did talk about being in the studio was very helpful, because if it had just been left to him, sometimes it would have been three sentences or a paragraph about a whole album. Right. So most of what he did on tape, but it was, you know, that book got put out in Japan in 2017. And I was really happy about that because it was with a really good publisher, and he has a huge fan base in Japan that I thought that book would be of service to. And Blackstone put it out here in audiobook. So, if, you know, but again, it's one of a number of Prince books that are out now. I think what was cool about ours is that it was like one of the first to get all those, you know, engineers under one roof. Obviously it's become a cottage industry, and as they should, to talk about their work with Prince, because that's such what a great accomplishment to, you know, and also, I mean, it would be arrogant for any author, of any genre, you know, to assume that because they did one book, that should be the only book on that particular, you know, musical kind of genre. He had his own genre. I mean, it wasn't just a sound. But at the same time, I there's another book I did that never came out that I really wish had, and it may someday. I wrote with Tomiko Dixon, Willie Dixon's granddaughter. And it was written with the Willie Dixon estate, and we interviewed an amazing collection of blues players, including Kingfish, who's really become like the big, you know, Kingfish these days. I mean, there's a lot of amazing musicians from Memphis in there, and the blues, Betty LeVette, and just some really cool Joe Satriani. And that was a really fun book to do, and I wish that someday comes out, because it really also captures the blues scene out of Chess Records and that whole Chicago sound, in terms of like Willie Dixon was writing for Chuck Berry, and he was writing, I mean, everybody that you can think of from the blues, you know, Howlin' Wolf and Sunhouse, and every great covered Willie Dixon, the Rolling Stones, Led Zeppelin, the Beatles, you know, so that would be a really cool book to see the light of day. But we also talk about Prince in there in terms of the influence that the blues had on him, kind of early going back to the era of the Robert Johnson, you know, kind of era. And
he was just an all around.
We're gonna jump in here a little bit, Jake. You are working on a couple of guys, a memoir that they're writing. They just happen to be talking to you right now.
Yeah.
We're trying to get this thing stuck and landed, and we're doing that. And you spent some time in Minnesota. What's different about what we're working with you on this particular project is obviously we are music producers and the like, but we're not artists. And you've worked with a lot of artists over the years and different backgrounds. But of course, talking to us about our memoir and what we want to do and reaching out to us and talking and putting something together, we're excited about it. It's two sides of the same coin. It's our heart and soul of what we ultimately want to do. We're doing a lot of other projects right now, whether we're working on some TV shows or other things, or this podcast is another piece of that. But the memoir is our core that we're working with you on, and we're excited to be working with you on that project. We couldn't have been blessed with a better author to
work with us on getting it done
on it. But our case is obviously, as you know,
that's kind of you. Thank you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We're excited about it. It's really the you know, it's what drives us, but we're excited to talk about that down the line. When we get this thing, you know, when we land this memoir. But again, you're working with a couple of guys that our background's a little bit different. And the story that we're telling is a little bit different than the studio productions that you worked with on so many different people. You know what we've been through. We shared it extensively with you. We're going to talk about that in the memoir. We're also going to talk about our background in music and things like that in the entertainment industry. We've got some fun stories to share.
But what I want to know, Thurl, is how did you came to us, so how did you find out about Roy and Thurl to want to, you know, obviously we're not well known.
Well, no, let's hold that part, because I don't think we want to reveal that yet. Let's hold that, Jake, because that's a story in and of itself.
Karen Cole, actually, we should give a little credit to. They're a broker that put us together.
Okay.
Really good, just to be fair, because she played a role in that.
Yeah, no, that well, the so point is that when Thurl told me about you wanting to reached out to him first about wanting to do this with us, I was
I gotta tell this story. Let me say this, Roy. Yeah. I gotta say this, Jake. When you reached out to me, I didn't know who you were, and I was like, you know, Roy and I were shopping a memoir. We're gonna do that. We knew that, and I get this contact information. You contacted me, and I didn't, like I said, I didn't know who you were. I didn't know who Jake Brown was and anything about that. And then you we had a brief conversation on the phone. We talked, and you told me a little bit about what you did and what your background was. And then I got off the phone. And I'm like, let me Google this guy. And then I looked you up, and I was like, what the? This is Jake Brown, you know, D. Jake Brown.
Then he calls me.
And then I called Roy and reached out to him and so forth, and the rest is history. But we'll share a little bit more in depth about that. But it's been quite a journey on us, and we're so happy that you were able to come in and join us on this podcast and talk to us about it. It's been something that we've been laboring to do. It was part of something that you suggested that we probably get a part of too. You were part of that team that initially said, hey, you guys, it's a good idea. So we're going to be talking more about the book and the things that's in the book. We've got some interesting stories to tell, some interesting stuff to share. Some of it you all know, you already know, is going to be quite controversial. We talk about what happened to us, the journey back from what happened to us, the losses that we've experienced, Roy and I, from these past couple of years. And we're going to tailor those into the book. We're going to talk about that extensively, our case, what the case that happened was all about, and the details of that case. That's all coming in the book.
If I can
go ahead.
Answer Roy's question, because that was part of what intrigued me about this. You know, so so there's 57 books in my own name, and then I've ghosted like another 40, and I would say probably 5 of those have been with people that went through the legal system.
Wow.
And came out and had to, you know, kind of, and you see the struggles, they're unique to anything else. In y'all's case, though, what intrigued me was the bullshit premise in which they leveraged your family to force you to take guilty pleas they might not have otherwise gotten in the course of a full trial. And as you said, we'll get into all that legally. But I think that having lived in Minnesota myself, and I think George Floyd's very tragic and just makes me cry thinking about it, death. When I lived up there, racism up there was sub-level in the sense that it was there, but it was not in what they wanted to be presented in the way that Minnesota is a very inviting place. Minneapolis is a beautiful city. St. Paul is a beautiful city. There's a lot of wonderful culture, and there's a lot of things that I think want to be focused on in the city that we should give full respect to. But we can all admit when you get out into the suburbs, it gets a little bit more, you know. So I felt like Prince this Jack. Was, yeah, I'm trying to be, you know, litigiously sensitive, but, and in case your parole officers are listening, but, you know, you guys have a legitimate story. No, I mean, just for us to say that, did you think 5-10 years ago you would say that? It's absurd. All you guys did was like good in the community. And, you know, I feel like there's a little bit of a racial element to why you wound up where you did. And I have no saying that because of the circumstances of everything the book will bear out to back it up. But it's really, you know, for all of his flaws and faults and mistakes and everything else about Donald Trump, we can completely acknowledge not being healthy. That First Step Act went through Democrat and Republican administrations previously. Right. Nobody else would sign it. So seeing how that, you know, even Thurl, I think you were telling me it affected how long you were going to have, you know what I mean? It's just, you know, it just very much intrigued me as a human interest story. It intrigued me as a story of injustice that needed to be examined in an in-depth memoir that actually doesn't really pull punches, but gives people an inside look at what you go through when you one day are living your life and running successful companies and employing a lot of people. That's something that nobody gives you guys credit for, but you guys were employing, like, I think upward of 100 people at the peak of everything you were doing and, you know, providing jobs and all this kind of thing. To have all of that taken from you along with your homes and relationship impacts and your freedom and then and all of that, I, you know, it offended me. And so I thought this is because I've written books of people that were guilty and they admitted they were guilty and they did what they did and they got out and paid their debt to society. And part of the point of the book was the moral search and finding the, a new path. You, in your all's case, I think it was very, you know, very different. And the way it was portrayed in the press was very manipulated and so forth. So in any event, I saw it as a act of kind of justice, to be quite honest, to get involved in it. And you know, it's a, you know, it's a great project in the sense that you guys have a story that precedes this, that deals with what you had to go through. And it's a story of perseverance and it's of frustration, obviously, but also hope and determination and keeping a level head. And, you know, there's people that can benefit from this, from reading about it as not a cautionary tale of you guys, but a cautionary tale of what can happen to you, depending on your skin color. And I think that's just in 2023. I don't think so. No. And I don't think that should exist anymore in our society. And like, and like Thurl and Roy have both alluded to here, the legal system is still so skewed toward making it harder for minorities to get out of prison and have the same shot as let's say someone of my complexion would. Let's just keep it real. And so I'm really it's an honor to be involved because it was so such an offensive and yet inspiring story, you know, the range and depth of what you guys were robbed of. It's incredible. I think when you have other guests on who have similar, you know, yours will stand out. I mean, even in competition of other people that have had a hard, I'm excited to get into it. You know,
we're excited to get this project completed with you. And again, you know, Thurl and I both, being the people that we are, you know, we are of the mindset that what doesn't destroy you makes you stronger. And so it gave us an extra footing, this experience, as far as finding our own voice and, you know, being the people that we are always into trying to help other people prosper. And so we can take this message and this experience and still continue to try and help people prosper. So with your help, again, with this memoir, it's going to continue to give us a voice. Gives us our own platform in terms of what we want to do going forward to try and continue to impact lives. This has given me an opportunity. This experience has given me an opportunity, like we've talked about earlier, to go to Washington and address these issues and meet with Congress people when I would have never thought to want to do that, you know, prior to this experience. And so, you know, again, it gives you a voice. It makes you stronger as a person. And then you realize that.
Yeah, would you have listed that among your accomplishments?
No.
I'm sorry, the feed cut off. I thought you were done talking. No, would you ever have thought you'd add that to your resume, like criminal justice reform advocates?
We were filming a reality show about our lifestyle and things like that when somebody showed up at our homes and our offices, and we were like, you know, and you don't prepare to go on national television to do a reality show about your life while you're out here doing things that you know you shouldn't be doing. Your life is an open book, and we've always lived our lives that way. So what happened to us was a shock. And Roy and I talk about this all the time, what we went through.
But the memoir will bring all that out. Yes.
But the memoir will speak to that, and it'll speak truth to power. And that's exactly what we're here to do with your help. But that's more for the memoir.
Before we you know, start to wrap this up, I do want to go back a little bit, Jake, and say, so what got you into writing? And when you got into, because you started off in music, what got you into writing and then subsequently wanting to do autobiographies or biographies?
You just asked my question. Sorry, that's a wild question.
Me first. It's probably Sway's question too.
Tell me who.
It was all my question, but he stole everybody's question.
Yes,
Go ahead, Jake.
I sure was going to ask that.
Go ahead.
Yeah, the progression of going in the first kind of few years in the, God, early 2000s, 2001 to 2005, with the Shakur Estate authorizing the Tupac in the Studio book, that led to Heart, that led to Motorhead, which I would also love to mention, Joe Satriani, Kenny Aronoff, Freddie Powers, Smo, Teddy. So there was a natural progression of just transitioning into doing only authorized work, and then memoir, as well as these other, the National Songwriter Series profiles all of the songwriters individually, as well as the stories behind their songs. So there's a balance in what I do. And that's another reason that I think when we first spoke that it seemed like a fit, because you all have an entertainment driven story that, as Roy pointed out, this diversion into the criminal justice system was just a part of, but the thematic theme of the story overall is the entertainment. That seemed like a good fit as well.
On that note, Jake, we just are any more questions, anybody? Because as we get ready to wrap Jake, because he's a busy man.
I was hoping you'd ask me one. You've been the quietest one here.
I have. I've been just taking it all in. Because you really answered the most important question when I was talking about Tupac and his late mother. Amy Winehouse, did you ever meet her personally, or did you just... No?
I just... felt like she was such a talent and and I mean everyone did, but yeah, sometimes when people die early earlier than they were meant to, or however one looks at that, some of the immediately following the death stuff that comes out can be a little bit, especially with her, really offensive to
the family.
And I knew some of the people that had worked with her musically, and they were really offended. And that wasn't a motivation from them. I just felt like when I got offered that contract, when you're a working writer, you take typically the contracts you're offered. Nowadays, I wouldn't again take like the Black Eyed Peas book. They're great. That was a pure money book. And looking back, I wouldn't have done it. But, as far as Amy Winehouse, I felt a little bit of a kind of a, as a fan of hers, kind of a responsibility, I guess, just to be among those trying to write about her life in a way that more accurately depicted, the positives, because every time you saw something about her, it was about how wasted she was, or how she was trashed at this, or how she was a controversial that, or how a tabloid this. And the music is the heart of why anyone, you know, she had an amazing voice, just maturity years beyond her age in terms of its, much like Adele or somebody like that. You know what I mean? It's just singular voice what a talent.
I just loved her music, and I just thought that how they depicted her in the media was not right. She was already gone. And the same way with Whitney Houston. I don't know if you ever got a chance to work with her or anything of that nature, but I just felt like, you know, it was bad. I didn't like it at all. I was like, let's speak on the positive, her music, what joy listening to her music brought to the world. Let's not, focus on the negative and, oh, she was wasted. Oh, she was on drugs. That's not how we want to remember a person.
And well, that's what we love about what he does. Yeah. I mean,
so, that's what I like about. I know I read some of the things that he's done. That's what I'm saying. I like.
Yeah, he's a noble writer.
Yeah, very
writer well conscious. There's not a lot of people. Mm-hmm. I shouldn't say there's not a lot. I'm sure there's a lot of authors.
There's a lot of great biographers out there. Yeah, the thing today with self-publishing that's such a kind of double-edged sword too is that that's the casualty of it. Is that, anybody can write. It's good because it gives more writers a chance to get their foot in the door. And there's, I'm not taking anything from it in terms of when it leads to something else, but you do see an inundation of biographies about, and you can look up anybody. This Sam, the guy that sells out like stadiums that has.
Is it Sam Cooke?
Sam, one of the, no. I can't think of his name.
I know who you're talking
Sam
about.
Sheridan. Is that his name?
I know what you're talking about. The singer.
That guy must have 15 books out on him. And it's like, and I don't think any of them are authorized. And it's, how can, Eminem must have 25 or 30 books out on him. It's And the thing that becomes, and some of these books are written by really credible music journalists who really know their thing. And if anyone's going to write a book that isn't so much authorized, but going to include interviews with, you want it to be with parties like that. But anyway, I feel like, the responsibility of anyone that's going to write about somebody else is to get it right and not get it right. How it's going to sell better because yeah. you tailor the narrative right. to this. And, you know, a competent writer can make anybody sound like anything. Right. This AI thing is going to be very interesting to see how plays into the future. Yeah.
That's going to be
what sad. Happens when computers start writing about people, right? Yeah. Like that's where we're.
Computers don't write with a conscience.
It's gonna be horrible.
Not unless they're programmed to. You know.
Do you think? Well, I just got to ask that. You think that's going to affect your business? Is that going to affect
it
as a whole?
Oh, it already has. Yeah. I'll give you an example. It affects ghostwriting. Ghostwriting is, I do books with, and then I do ghost or books like with y'all, where I'm helping your names will be on up and I'm helping you write it, but it's your voices. If you had a stock and trade, who's somebody that right now would be, I mean, you can list so many different people that are in these new generations of acts that I'm just a little old to think of. There are so many books being written right now by computers or help being written by computers or I should say bios. And it's starting to head that way. And the thing that the casualty of that is going to be more the interaction between a biographer and their subjects. As an example, on a much bigger level than any of us, let's say a movie studio can start. This is what the strike has been about most recently. Can a computer generate a script?
And it's still going on.
Do you need the writer anymore if a computer can write it? You know, I mean, it's frightening. But you know what? What I think that's really leveling about technology in a way, though, is think of the people that used to work on an assembly line at a car manufacturing plant or at a clothing designer factory or anywhere where there was a human element to creating something that is now done by computer that costs them their job. So it would be arrogant for me to be like, oh, well, we're writers. It shouldn't happen to us. It's like, it's inevitable and it just makes it more competitive. And you just have to be more entrepreneurial and reinvent yourself in the little ways that all of us do. But yeah, it's coming. It's coming for everything. James Cameron was prophetic. The Terminator that I grew up as a kid watching was prophetic.
Right. Here it comes.
Hopefully there won't be nuclear weapons killing us off, but it's definitely...
That's called war games. Sway, you got one more
war question? War games, too.
Before you go?
Yeah. I do.
She's got one more question, Sway.
Knowing that you write for like all these people, do you like just write for yourself, whether that's like poetry, whether you're just like writing down your emotions, your feelings of just anything?
That's a wonderful question. I'm a published songwriter of almost 300 songs, and I have a lot of studio projects that I play everything on, perform and sing and do all the instruments and write everything. And I find it more comfortable to just do that myself because I've been doing it for so long with groups that it became like, okay, songwriting is the heart and soul of what you're talking about. And, I'm not going to say I'm in the league of a lot of the people I write with mainly, but yeah, one of my bands is the Nashville Suns, which is a all studio band, but it's on Spotify and everywhere else. YouTube and so forth. The wonderful thing about that too, is they're all under other names. And so no one knows it's me. And so I have the freedom to just write stylistically in any kind of medium. And also I was very lucky to link up with an amazing engineer named Aaron Harmon back in 2009. Aaron today is a multi-platinum record producer of Black Bear and all kinds of groups. He said, I can't even count the number of hundreds of millions of streams his songs have been enough. So he's amazing. So I can go in with him and we can bang out a whole four or five songs in 2 or 3 hours, just laying down instruments. Moves really fast and in Nashville also, I live around so many musicians that are so superior to me in their particular like lead guitar or drummers but within being a songwriter, you can find your own kind of path and voice and not have to per se share publishing credits and then if you do get, there's so many wonderful co-writers as well in this town. If you want to write with other people, you have that option as well. So but that's where that would land.
Mm-hmm. We're going to close on that excellent question.
All right.
We can talk to you all day, Jake.
We've got to have you back on. We appreciate you
coming on after the book is completed, and we'll be talking about the things
you bet.
That we can talk about. We're so excited. I know you're busy out there, and it's Nashville, right? It's kind of where you make your home.
It's Saturday, though, man. Yeah, it's just my wife coming home soon.
Grand
Ole
Opry. Yeah, Grand Ole Opry.
I'll be done with using the house by then. But yeah, Nashville's great, and it's been very good to me as a town, and I call it home. And my dog and my wife live here, and my house is here. So there you go.
Right.
Pretty much, we're you know.
Well, this has been a long time coming. We've been trying to get you on the show, and we'll get the show up and going and get it started. And we're so happy to have you here.
And happy to do
talking
it.
Talking with us. It's been a pleasure.
Nice to meet you.
All right.
Nice to meet all of you. Yeah, you should keep these two as part of your extended
family. Hey, they're part of the family.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Part of the family.
Yeah.
I'm so glad to have them. On that note, Jake, we're going to be in touch about the other project that we're working on, the book.
Sounds good.
And look forward to talking to you some more, my friend.
And getting
likewise. Take care, guys.
All right.
Thanks for having me on.
Bye.
All right. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.